The Spectator magazine is home to wonderful writing, insightful analysis, and unrivaled books and arts reviews. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, along with a free £20 John Lewis or Waitrose voucher. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to the Spectator's Book Club podcast. I'm Sam Leith, the literary editor of The Spectator. This week, I'm very pleased to be joined by the novelist Percival Everett. He's a Pulitzer nominee, he was shortlisted for the Booker Prize for his novel The Trees, and his new book is James, which is a retelling of the adventures of Huckleberry Finn from the point of view of the enslaved Jim with whom Huck is on the run. Percival, welcome. Can I start by asking you, when was it that you thought, you know, there was something to be done about Huckleberry Finn? There was an opening there for your own work.
Oh, I have to say, I did not have a long burning desire to do this. I didn't think of it until 3 or so years ago. I asked myself the question, had this been done? Had anyone told the story from Jim's point of view? And I didn't know. So I went and I started searching, and turned out, as far as I could see, no one had. And I wondered why. And then I realized that at my advanced age, I hadn't thought of it either. And so I decided to do it.
What was your first encounter with Huckleberry Finn yourself? When you taught it at school, you know, it's such a big part of the children's canon in the States.
Well, I read an abridged version that was in our house when I was maybe 7 or 8. And I don't know what made it abridged. It was shorter, but I didn't know there was any other version of it. And I don't remember it very well. It wasn't my favorite book. I did not like Tom Sawyer at all. I gave Huck Finn a chance, and it was better. I liked Mark Twain quite a bit. I read Life on the Mississippi and Roughing It with relish when I was a kid. And so I was shaped by Twain as far as humor and irony go from early on. And then as a teenager, I returned to the unabridged Huck Finn. And obviously as a Black American teenager, the novel was problematic because of the use of a particular word. But given the context, it was not offensive. It simply was a part of that world. And it was clearly a novel that was about, it was opposed to the idea of slavery, and was conceptually a picture of a adolescent America trying to deal with race. And so it became an important book to me.
In your book, one of the things that's really striking is that the adventure that James is on and that the adventure that Huck's on, even though they're taking place a lot of the time in the same physical space, are radically different in terms of the stakes and, you know, the dangers. Is that something present in Twain's book as well, do you think? Or was that something you went this...
Well, in fairness to Twain, he was writing the story of Huck Finn, of a white boy who sees the world as a child sees the world. And so for him, it's this adventure. And the stakes are significantly different. James is the story of an adult man, someone who has a child, has a wife, and is confronted with the possibility of torture and worse repercussions if he ventures too far afield. So the world is different for him. And so the story is different. They encounter, you know, much in the way you and your kids go on vacation. For you, it's keeping up with people and looking for bathrooms. For them, it's great fun. And so it's a different world.
And I'm intrigued by how much, when you approach this, you said, you know, Twain was kind of, in some respects, a master to you as a kind of an influence, a mentor in terms of prose. Was there a rebuke implied towards a failure of moral imagination in Twain when you set about this?
Oh, no.
Did you feel it's more of a complimentary thing?
Not at all. And I never meant this novel to issue from any kind of dissatisfaction with Twain's novel. And it's certainly not a corrective. I flatter myself to think that I'm in conversation with Twain, that, again, his novel, he chooses to tell this story from the point of view of Huck Finn. That's limiting, but correctly limiting. You know, it would be strange for him to enter the mind of anyone else in the story. It is true that his depiction of Jim is simplistic and does not give Jim his full humanity, but no one had done this before. My novel is the novel that Twain was not equipped to write. He could not have written Jim's story. He had not experienced Jim's story, and, well, nor have I, but I can lay claim to my ancestors having experienced Jim's story and understanding what it's like for us to occupy a certain place within the culture. So that psychic and cultural space that Jim inhabits simply was not available to Twain.
The language of James is a huge part of it. And there's this kind of almost Toy Story-like thing whereby, you know, when the white people are around, the black people speak in this kind of lordy, lordy, I'd been stealing chickens idiolect. And then when the white people are off stage, they speak, you know, about Voltaire and Kierkegaard and so forth.
Which probably much closer to the truth.
Yeah.
That people find a way to speak to each other in the presence of their enemies in ways that don't allow entry.
And is that, I mean, I'm wondering that sort of particular idiolect, which is, I think, a feature of the way Twain wrote Jim, if I'm fair on that, and has been a big feature in a kind of sort of caricatural idea of how black people spoke in the 80s. I'm wondering how much is that idiolect something that we know existed, and how much is it a sort of creation of minstrelsy, because minstrelsy is in here?
Well, like art, the imitation goes both ways. There were some recordings from the 30s of the, you know, I can't remember the WPA in the United States, where people would travel around recording folk songs and doing oral histories. And there are some recordings of former slaves talking about their experience. And they're obviously quite old at this time, but it's a reminder of just how close in time slavery is to us. And what's striking about them is they do not sound at all like the stereotypic voices that film and literature have given to slaves.
You know, I mentioned minstrelsy. You've put into one of the interstices in Twain's book, you put Daniel Decato Emmett.
Yes.
What made you want to do that? What were you about with that section?
Well, Emmett's a fascinating character. He's credited for having written the song Dixie, which became an anthem for the South. Ironically, he was from the North and actually participated on the Union side, not as a soldier, but worked in the war effort, and was always unhappy that his song had been used as an anthem for the Confederate States. It's likely that he didn't write that song, but simply took credit for it. What's interesting about that is it's one of the songs in his oeuvre that is not offensive. You know, you can listen to it and it is offensive because of the way it's been used, but the lyrics are not nearly as offensive as his other lyrics. He had a minstrel group, white men who would dress up in blackface and wander around performing mainly in the South at that time, and performing obviously for white people. It was a derogatory and fun-making effort about black people, and that was considered entertainment. I wanted it because minstrelsy is fascinating, but I wanted a scene with some layers of passing, of the ironies of self-identification, of just identity. And so Jim is actually purchased by Emmett, which is strange since Emmett was opposed to slavery, supposedly. And his hiring of Jim, as he tells Jim, "You've been hired, not purchased," amounts to slavery. But he
Jim doesn't make a distinction between chattel slavery and slavery. And
exactly.
Emmett's like, what?
And so there's a scene where Jim is put into blackface to look like a white man passing for a black man. And I just love that.
It is. I can imagine you actually kind of sitting at your desk cackling with laughter. So, I mean, are you someone who does laugh as you write?
Not usually, but I did like that scene.
One of the things that will strike people, I think, about, you know, any of your books, is that they are as funny as hell. Do you think of yourself as a comic novelist?
No. I don't think about being funny. I'm sometimes surprised when people tell me that something is funny. I try not to be offended, but
I'm sorry, it was meant as a compliment.
No worries.
Is humor, because, you know, your books are dealing with some of the darkest material available.
Yes.
Is humor a way of sort of snagging the reader then, or is it a does it come in some complicated relationship with anger, say?
I think both. And that use of humor is something I learned from Twain. That's another nice irony. Twain's humor arises from his observations of human beings and the absurdity of their behavior. And that's where I look for humor, too. I think that I never tell jokes, but that what's funny is people.
Yeah. Your books are enormously various in style and tone and genre. Do you see a kind of common thread in them? And do you think you have, like, a subject or a guiding thing? Or is each one different?
Well, I think at the base of all of my work is an interrogation of the whole storytelling endeavor. Not only why we tell stories, but what it means to make sense of a story. I love nonsense. And what I love about nonsense is that, and I mean nonsense like, you know, Victorian nonsense. And the beauty of nonsense is it must adhere more rigidly to form, to syntax, and to the rules of grammar than what we consider to be sense. And that's how it works. It tricks us into thinking it should mean something, but it doesn't. But the fact that we think it should mean something means an awful lot. And that's where I reside when I come to telling stories.
And telling stories is part of Jim's story. And Jeb's, you know, he's got this pencil.
Yes.
Acquired at very considerable cost. I mean, is there a sense to you that you think that writing his own book is, or writing his own story is a kind of act of reparation, that you can sort of make yourself heard, or you know, giving voice to the previously voiceless as a project?
I think that's where my thinking was initially, and I think it's changed slightly in that I'm not attempting to give James agency. I'm attempting to give his agency an amplifier in the same way that his voice already exists, but he has no place to have it recognized. And that's where writing comes into play. He knows who he is, but he cannot show himself as he moves through the world because of the repercussions of the knowledge of his literacy.
And he's also, you say, he can't show himself, he can't, you know, he knows that the white people are going to be alarmed if they know how much cleverer he is than them. There are various points at which, when he's more freaked out by the apparent surface benignity of Daniel Emmett than he is by the sort of straightforward malignity of the majority of the kind of slave-owning people. Why is it that someone like Emmett sets his radar off? Is it because he's a less-known quantity?
Oh, there's a certain pretense that Emmett is moving through the world with. And that's actually why the Enlightenment philosophers are present in this text. Emmett espouses this belief in a world where slavery is wrong. But when we get right down to it, he finds way of justifying the very thing that he claims to find objectionable. That's a lot harder to deal with in the world than having someone simply be your enemy and want to imprison you.
Yeah, and the Enlightenment philosophers, you come in, it's Locke, I think, specifically, isn't it? He has a
Locke
particular
is
beef with.
Locke and Voltaire, and Rousseau as well. And they're there actually as stand-ins for Thomas Jefferson, who didn't write any philosophy that Jim would be able to find in the library of Judge Thatcher. So
felt like a reach. He might have been able to find Kierkegaard in the library of Judge Thatcher, but would he have got to the antebellum South at that time?
Yeah, actually, he would have. One of the things I love about, and this is going to sort of an aside, when Darwin's book, The Origin of Species, came out, and it came to the U.S., people couldn't wait to grab it. And part of this was, and this the whole discussion about slavery and changing, thinking about things, that book got passed around by intellectuals saying, "Now you're done with it." and I love that idea. Sometimes I wish there were only a couple of copies of James that we could spread around.
Why did Twain decide to set his story, you know, he was writing after the war, to set it in this sort of antebellum period? Was there a kind of nostalgia in it? What was his...
Well, it was his childhood.
That was his childhood.
And he needed Jim to be a slave. The last third of the novel is where Twain's novel falls apart. For me, it becomes an adventure with the reinsertion of a character, Tom Sawyer. My initial reading of that was that it was a response to Twain's financial concerns. It becomes a mercenary endeavor because he was famously in need of money. Tom Sawyer was his money-making character and made sense to bring him back. Since then, I don't know if it's a more charitable reading, but certainly an interesting one that sort of came to me after talking to a Twain scholar. And Twain had gone back to his home in Missouri after the war, during Reconstruction. And he was appalled by the treatment of freed slaves during the period following the war. And that the treatment of Jim, very much like a pawn by the two boys, Huck and Tom, in a way symbolize how the enslaved were treated after the war. Yes, you're free, but not really. And this world is not really yours. We're going to move you around. That's an interesting reading of it. And I like it. And it doesn't matter whether Twain meant it at all. So I try to be more generous about the end of the novel.
I read somewhere that you said you'd reread The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn like 50 times or something.
15.
15.
And I counted those because I needed to inhabit the world and not the text. And I also needed to forget the text in order to own that world. And so I read it until I was truly sick of it. By the fifth reading, I hated the novel so much. But I needed to know it and have it be a blur. And that's why I read it so many times.
And did you feel you had... I mean, I don't know how much freedom. I haven't reread The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn for some years. Did you feel like you were only going to play within the interstices of the established text, or would you let yourself tweak here and there? I mean, did you feel you had to be faithful to Twain's architecture?
Well, no, that's why I needed to inhabit the world and not the text. I felt at the end that I owed no loyalty to the words that were on the page, but I wanted to be true to the world that existed. Much of Twain's novel exists with Huck and Tom separated. Obviously, it being from Huck Finn's point of view, we don't know what's going on with Jim. I said Tom, but I meant Jim. And so those places were the easier ones for me to be different. But since his experience in the absence of Huck are different, it shades his experience with Huck. So that was fine. And the world is significantly different because it's being viewed through the eyes of an adult man instead of an adolescent boy.
Jim's moral status in the book feels at various points quite compromised. I mean, he's weighed down with guilt. Do you think he comes away tarnished in your story?
Tarnished, no. I think the extreme actions that he ends up taking, in his mind, having had these Enlightenment philosophers as his model, provide a weird kind of justification that perhaps we should all feel tarnished about, but not James.
There's a debate, I mean, I think it rages on both sides of the Atlantic, about the extent to which children's stories and the texts of the past, which are now, you know, hashtag problematic, should still occupy a place in the canon and be taught to children. I mean, as you say, Huck Finn is by no means the worst. But where do you stand on that? I mean, do you feel it's a problem to teach these things in schools?
Why would teaching a novel that is opposed to slavery be a problem to anyone? Now, I understand.
Liberty scattered with the N-word.
Yeah, well, you know, sometimes education is difficult. The presence of the word is illustrative of the world in which the work was made. To remove it is to present that time as different and to present it not truthfully. Yes, it's a difficult word for us, and it's always been offensive, but that's the point of it. We need to understand why it's offensive. Imagine a world where this word exists, we don't use it, but there's no history attached to it so that generations don't understand the offense of it. That makes no sense at all. You can't understand the power of the word without understanding the history and how it was used and what it meant and why the word has lived on in this offensive way.
Actually, there is a bit in the book where you have Jim saying he's got Daniel Decatur Emmett's songs, and he's like, do I destroy these? But decides against it. Is it for that reason, is it?
Well, yes. Yeah, certainly.
And I wonder, you've worked on a text that already exists. In The Trees, you've got some, you know, you talk about the lynching of Emmett Till and that history and weave a kind of gothic horror detective story around it. How much did you feel your fantasy needed to be rooted? Because you've got real people, mm-hmm. historical figures there. Did you sort of say these historical figures are just for my purposes for this book? Or did you feel you had to know about Carolyn Bryant or the...
No, you don't need to know who Carolyn Bryant is. It's, in my mind, it's... Why should we bother knowing who Carolyn Bryant is? Knowledge of facts don't really have anything to do with truth.
Are there living people who are descendants of these guys? I'm just wondering whether... Well, in Money, Bryant, Mississippi, there are people reading The Trees going, hey, that's my uncle.
I doubt that very seriously. These are the people who should read the novel and I think would benefit from it, but they're not going to.
No. Does the world of James, as you see it, kind of press on the present?
Oh, well, I think all art necessarily does that. It was created in this moment. So it is an expression of this moment. Well, as an artist, I hope that it does.
Percival Everett, thank you very much indeed for your time.
Thank you.